windy today.
No, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware, we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. We're here at the table with our coffee and our tea, and Lord knows what we're drinking today. But anyway, I'm Dan, and here with me is...
I'm Dane.
I'm Ray.
And I'm Bill.
And this is a follow-up on our first show, which was a discussion on guns. And we got a question, three questions actually, from a listener, and we wanted to take a little bit of time to address that. The comment from the listener was basically, great discussion. How do you gentlemen interpret the text of the Second Amendment? What is a well-regulated militia? Is the Army National Guard a well-regulated militia? There are three questions there. So, Bill, let me go ahead and turn it over to you because you did some research on it and you've got one take on it. So, go.
The Second Amendment was adopted on December 15, 1791. It reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, so what does well-regulated mean? In the District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008, the United States Supreme Court stated that the adjective well-regulated implies nothing more than the imposition of proper discipline and training. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Court in 2007 said, the amendment does not protect the right of militiamen to keep and bear arms, but rather the right of the people. The operative clause, properly read, protects the ownership and use of weaponry beyond that needed to preserve the state militias. So, is the Army National Guard a well-regulated militia? There's a couple different views on that one.
I took the liberty of using a dictionary to see what they had to say about it. First of all, on as far as regulated is concerned, I remember reading somewhere a long time ago that the term in use then basically meant, as Bill, as you implied, was properly trained, et cetera. What I had seen on that also said well-equipped, which meant something other than just a ragtag set of troops. The dictionary definition is a military force that is raised from the civilian population to supplement a regular army in an emergency, a military force that engages in rebel or terrorist activities, typically in opposition to a regular army, or all able-bodied citizens eligible by law for military service. Wikipedia defines a militia as generally an army or some other type of fighting unit that is composed of non-professional fighters, citizens of a nation, or subjects of a state or government who can be called upon to enter a combat situation, as opposed to a professional force of regular full-time military personnel. Historically, I know that our founding fathers did not want a standing army since they had just won America's independence from England's standing army. They saw, philosophically as I see it, they saw a balance of power within the whole structure of the government. And when I look at the First and the Second Amendments, I see two amendments that basically are their two top concerns. They're not the 12th Amendments or the 46th Amendments. They're the first and the second. The first ultimate weapon that you have as a means of countering any kind of, if you're talking political power, what you have is speech. You have freedom of speech. Freedom of speech allows you as an individual to basically hook up your ideas with some other individual and say, well, you know, I don't like Bob over here. Let's go punch him in the nose and we'll take charge. It's the ability to organize a group of people into some sort of ideology. So the freedom of speech is, I mean, if somebody came along, for example, and said that all of your email that you send out from now on had to be censored through a government censorship, how would you react to that? You would feel threatened. You would feel like something's amiss here, that something's not going right. The Second Amendment is something that is pretty primitive and pretty basic as I see it. It's something that you have the right, or let me express it this way. The pen is mightier than the sword as long as you have the sword to back it up. But if you don't have the sword, the pen's worthless. Your right to free speech, so to speak, is only as good as your ability to enforce it. And force is the operative word there, that your right to free speech, if you're being oppressed, you come to a point where you say, no, I can't talk my way out of this one. So you resort to force as means of doing that. And to me, this is what the founding fathers were seeing, is that they wanted checks and balances. So the first two amendments deal with the ability to talk about the king in a way that you express opposition to that his ideas or his ruling or whatever. And then if that all fails, as is was the case with the Romanian Revolution, for example, you can amass a group of people. That's a show of power. That the Romanian Revolution, say that fast 10 times in a row. That's something where that's exactly what happened. It came down to force. The people, there was such a large crowd of people that were contesting the government in that case that they did not need any armament. The military forces at that time, they just simply disarmed and took off their uniforms and they joined in with the people because it was just an overwhelming force. What happens when you have when you have a weaponry involved is it makes it a little easier. You don't quite need as many people, and that also becomes a subject for the debate as to, you know, you have small bands of guerrillas, for example, that oppose just about anything at any given time. But to me, this is what I see philosophically at the top of the First and Second Amendments, and then the rest of it is important as well. But to me, the Founding Fathers saw the First and the Second as the most important things that were on their mind at that time.
Can I address that, Dan? Because I found a really good quote. The final question the listener had asked was, is the Army National Guard a well-regulated militia? An article from John Liberty, dated November 27th of 2013, he states at the tail end of his writing, this is obviously a false interpretation for this simple reason. All rights described in the Bill of Rights apply specifically and solely to the people, not to the government or any component of it. If the framers wanted to specify that government-controlled entities could be armed, they would have included language to the effect elsewhere in the Constitution. That the rights of the people to keep and bear arms is in the Bill of Rights is confirmation that it is an individual right of each citizen, just as much as all the other rights described in the First Ten Amendments.
I wonder, you started off by saying that this was primitive rights or a primitive thing, and I think it is kind of primitive in a way. I wonder if the people who wrote the Second Amendment, when to fire a gun, you fired at a rate of about 2 or 3 rounds a minute, if they knew that in the year 2017 we'd have guns that you could readily buy in the store that fire 500, 600, and 700 rounds a minute, or if they saw the bodies of 26 6-year-olds laying in their kindergarten classroom and things like that, or the guy walking into his place of business where he just got fired and shoot 8 or 9 of his coworkers, or we were just discussing how many police are killed a year now. Would they have worded that a little bit differently? Would there be some differences in that?
Well, you can extrapolate that even further. You can simply take it all the way up to the hydrogen bomb. Does the individual citizen have the right to keep a hydrogen bomb in his basement just in case?
Well, I don't know why we're not. If you're strictly using the words here, the right to bear arms, where does that right to bear arms end? The First Amendment stops at yelling fire in a crowded theater. Why can't I have a hand grenade? Why can't I go down to Bi-Mart and buy a case of hand grenades? That's an arm.
Well, because
and they're impinging on my right to buy hand grenades.
They're a bit expensive. I don't know whether if you've priced hand grenades lately.
Well, so are Lexus is expensive, and so is a pickup truck.
Right. But no, I think the bigger issue is that you have a line that needs to be drawn somewhere. We don't want Kim Jong-un with a hydrogen bomb. We most certainly don't want me to have one in my basement because I'm clumsy. No. There's a line that I think that's what the argument is about today, is that there's a line somewhere. Where do you draw that line? The Supreme Court, I believe, back in the 20s, basically drew the line or the court system. I'm not going to say the Supreme Court. It seems like I read the Supreme Court. We'll have to fact check it. But they drew the line at machine guns and basically said the average citizen can't own a machine gun. And it's been argued about shotguns and pistols and everything else for years now. And that's where it's all stuck, is in the courts over petty little decisions that are made over whether this gun is a militia gun or this gun fits that bill. And they've attempted to draw the line at basically small arms that have a slow rate of fire, et cetera.
It's not that difficult to get a machine gun permit, though.
It really isn't.
It's not.
It's expensive. Buying the gun itself, it's expensive, and the permit is a couple of $1,000s.
Exactly. For a couple of $1,000s, you can buy the permit, and you are, as an American citizen, allowed, if you don't have any felonies, to have a machine gun. And you certainly can.
And I believe that a background check is fairly extensive for that, is it not?
It's the same, as long as you don't have any felonies.
Is it? It's just the money?
It's just the money.
Maybe dependent on the state that you're applying in, perhaps.
You might be right. That could be.
Mm-hmm. But it is a federal license that you have to
correct.
Yeah, secure it's specific, in order to do that.
Yeah. I personally know somebody who has one of those permits that if I had anything to say about it, he wouldn't have one. He's not dealing with a full deck.
Yeah. Well, that's not the issue that we're discussing,
right.
I don't think.
Can I go into a little detail on the reason, the reason that America put in the Second Amendment was because during the Revolution, when we were fighting the British, the black powder, because it was so explosive, was commonly kept, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing off the article, but the black powder was kept in a center area in each village because it was so explosive, and oftentimes everybody's individual powder supply was included right in there with everyone else's. The British, in order to take over the American colonies, was ordered to come in and take that powder so that the civilians could not fight back. It was because of that that all of the citizens then went in, got their powder, and started sniping, basically, the British soldiers as they were coming in to take their weapons. And so, therefore, it became a mandate that all citizens in the United States keep their weapons, keep their powder, and be ready to fight so that the British can't come in, take the powder, and just dominate them. That simple.
That's the type of thing, though, that you kind of wonder, why is there even a Second Amendment? Because the original idea of that was the idea that we could have a well-regulated militia. People would be ready to defend themselves from, in that time, the British or a tyrannical government taking over.
But have you looked at Venezuela?
I don't care how many guns you have in your basement. And I used to know people when I lived in Nome who ordered 223 ammunition, 1,000 rounds at a time, because Russia was just a little bit away, and you never know, they might be coming. But they weren't coming with rifles. They were coming with the most incredible weapons imaginable. And that's what the average citizen today cannot defend himself from a tyrannical government by calling on the Second Amendment or saying, I have a gun with a bunch of bullets.
Do you remember the Japanese quote? We cannot invade America, because there's going to be an American behind every tree with a weapon.
I
And that was their quote.
Do you have a cite for that quote? I've heard that that's not true.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, I don't have a cite for that, so you might be right, but...
If I may, I would try to answer your question of why a Second Amendment. A person would make an amendment saying they're, you know, this right shall not be infringed in order to defend yourself against possible infringement, or they believed that an infringement could be possible. So they created an amendment to prevent that. And that would be the reason why the Second Amendment at all.
Well, if you're going to take over a country, what would be the first thing that you would want to control? The press? What would be the second thing you would want to control? Weaponry.
If you control the press well enough, though, you really don't have to. You know, it's commonly said that the first thing Hitler did was take all the guns away from the German people, but that's not true.
That's not true.
Hitler was not a despot to the German people, but he controlled the German people with taking over the press and with his speeches and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So if corporations control our media, are we being taken over?
To some extent. Well,
that is really a good question, and that's a good show.
Maybe
and
another
that's
time.
That's another discussion, yes.
Yes, very much so.
Well, let's go back to these original three questions, because I do have one further comment to make on it. And we're just talking about the Second Amendment, and this can go on for a long time. We'll probably take it up again later on and discuss it more at length. But he's asking three questions. The first one is... what is a well-regulated militia? And we've pretty well answered that. It means it's basically well-equipped, and it's a military force that is from the citizenry, from the people. Okay, so his question is, how do you gentlemen interpret the text of the Second Amendment? And I think we've done a fairly good job of addressing that. And his second question is, what is a well-regulated militia? I think we've answered that one. The only one that I really see hanging at this point is the Army National Guard, a well-regulated militia. And I think that if the Army National Guard is controlled by the government, then it would not be a militia.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
The militia is of and by the people against the government.
Right.
So the government cannot police itself.
So, Bill, I don't recall seeing that in the definition for a militia. The against the government part, was that in there?
Right into a discussion about the modern use of professional soldiers. I mean, that's not by the people, really. By
private soldiers, private armies. Private armies.
Scary, mm-hmm. scary, scary. Very scary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, do we want to just kind of table this for the time being?
Well, I'll go around. I have a final comment.
Go.
Okay. I don't object to people owning guns. I have several guns myself. But I have to say that every time I see a car with an NRA sticker in the back window, I feel like getting my Glock out from under my seat and shooting the windows out. I think if I were an NRA member, I would definitely push very hard to have the NRA clean up their act. They're becoming a radical organization. Over the past several weeks, every time I turned on YouTube, they were running these outrageous ads that were anti-government ads. They weren't even pro-gun ads. They talked about they are doing this, and who they are is the government. And they were really very, very vicious ads. They stopped the very day that Charlottesville mm-hmm. happened. I don't know if that's coincidence or they realized that they are fomenting that type of activity by having these ads.
Okay, so I think we've got this one in the bag, so to speak.
That was your final comment. Did you get a final comment, Bill? Do you feel
I had plenty of mic mm-hmm. time.
Okay. Do I have anything?
I'm glad you laughed to show that was a joke. I don't have a Glock under my.
Dan, would you like to thank the questioner, revolver. Or shall I use my final comment to thank the questioner and ask if they followed up there?
Briefly, just a reminder.
Yes.
Is the National Guard the Army? What was it?
Is the National Guard a militia?
The Army National Guard.
Right.
The National Guard cannot be the militia if one of the presumed functions of the militia is to serve the people's final balance of power against the federal government.
Got it.
The National Guard is an arm of the U.S. government, and an arm cannot serve as a protection against itself.
Not according to this. It is a military force that is raised from the civilian population to supplement a regular army in an emergency.
What dictionary is that?
And that's why some people think that the National Guard then is the militia.
That's right.
The second is a military force that engages in rebel or terrorist activities, and the third is all able-bodied civilians eligible by law for military service.
18 to 24 years old. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state not country, free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And so you're absolutely right. It is a mandate as they're setting up their government to have the militia so that in times of being attacked by supposedly the British troops or soldiers, they could draw the militia, pull them together to defend the new country of America. And so you're right. The militia was originally intended to be an arm of the government to serve and help protect the government of the United States of America.
But the original formation of the militias under George Washington were as a rebel unit. They were rebelling against the king.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were. They fit the definition of engaged in rebel or terrorist activities, typically in opposition to King George's army.
Or taxation without representation, or any kind of political upheaval where the government went too far. And so in order to rein that back and take back our government and get it back for the people, then the militia steps up.
Is it an insurgency in that case?
Basically, yes, it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would be an insurgency to take over.
Mm-hmm. If you were a revolutionist, you had a warrant for your standing warrant for your arrest, and you would be hung or shot or whatever. Just as simple as that. You were a traitor.
You were a traitor to that form of government.
Right.
But if you had so many people behind you, you could then take over that government and have it for the people, which is what the majority wanted.
That's how Castro did it, right?
What's really interesting is I've been watching Venezuela right now, and based on my research, that's one of the hot spots. There's over 10,000 people killed a year down in Venezuela right now for the last 3 or 4 years. The people down there have had their weapons taken away from them, and it shows. And they have a new dictator. They voted him in, and then he voted himself additional power, additional power, additional power. And so now he's a dictator. And it shows the military vehicles coming in and blasting all the protesters with water tanks, water cannons, all kinds. And the people have no defense whatsoever against this tyrant or the government themselves. If you have no weapons, you certainly can't defend yourself, which brings up a valid point of why you would keep weapons, regardless. I mean, this is right now. We're talking about Venezuela right now in 2017. I've seen war fights amongst the people and the governments on the news almost nightly. So I'm not so sure that America is secure in that it's going on elsewhere around the world, and it's huge over in China and the Asia continent. There's an awful lot of disruption over there. Is it not warranted here? I don't know. I'm not so sure. I'm ready to just give away my weapons and say, oh, yeah, everything's great and wonderful, because it's kind of like North Korea. It's the same thing. When you listen to the news at night, they talk about how America has requested all these countries give up their nuclear warheads. As soon as they did, they were taken over. Hmm. And so Kim Jong-un is saying, no, I'm not backing off of my, I give away my nukes and then I'm taking over. No, thank you. Fair appraisal.
Is that a direct quote, Bill?
It is.
Okay, thanks.
So we want to say thank you to our listener for firing in a question that we have now discussed at some length. And we want to encourage even more as we continue on with this discussion at Brookings Cafe. Please send us your comments, send us your questions, and above all, volunteer to come down here and join the discussion with us. We're all just sitting around and having a nice cup of coffee or a cup of iced tea or whatever this stuff is I brought.
This is a scary subject we're going to bring up. I'm having a glass of wine.
Yes. Yeah, so thank you, and please send more. So let's move on to our topic for the day, which is artificial intelligence, and just kind of throw out some ideas to just kind of get some conversation going. I'd like to basically address what I think is going to be the big issue that comes along with artificial intelligence. Imagine somebody walks in the room and they suddenly say something like, well, I think I'm going to start a new religion. And they write it down on a piece of paper and they ask, or maybe they don't ask, maybe they say, I want you guys to all be followers, and it's not a request, it's an order. You will, in fact, follow the philosophy that I lay forth. Is that a possibility? You're talking about another entity coming in the room, and the prediction that I read today was that the intelligence of artificial intelligence could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 times more intelligent than us. So what does that put the IQ at, somewhere at 1,100 or something like that? Or no, you're talking about multiplying. Yeah, somewhere in there, I guess. Anybody a mathematician in the room? We're talking about something that could be very, very intelligent and conceivably offer answers to problems we have, like global warming, a lot of our political problems, the proliferation of nuclear armament. All of these problems that we have conceivably could be addressed by some sort of a super-duper intelligence. Is this a scary thought that somebody might come in and suddenly say that your religion is void? Your philosophies are all void, and that now we will operate by a new system. Democracy is void. Is it scary? Is it a good thing? Is it going to creep in on us and just we're all just going to think it's a lot of fun like we do with our phones now?
On the good side, in the medical front, there's been some amazing developments. I've read an article where they're using robots, now not robots, but technology to read x-rays, and they read the x-rays much more accurately than human radiologists do. I also read that they can diagnose problems with the eyes. Right now I have a couple of problems with my eyes, and I'm looking forward to having some eye surgery, and I just read that these machines can diagnose problems in the eyes about 10 times more accurately than a doctor can. And the scary part for me is that they show the doctor an eye, have him diagnose it, and then 20 minutes later, they'd show him the same eye, and he'd give a different diagnosis where the machine was not doing that. That's some good things. Also, there's a remote surgery. So now we can, if somebody has some kind of a horrible thing happen to them in a relatively rural area like this, if we can get them to an operating room that has this remote surgery equipment, the greatest surgeon to take care of that particular problem in New York or Istanbul or wherever he happens to be can perform that surgery. That's an amazing leap forward.
We definitely accept pretty much all the apps that we have on our phone. It does a lot of amazing things. I've got this thing at home. I'm afraid to say the word Alexa because then she'll pop up and ask me what it is that I'm talking about. So it's a word that I don't say at home.
Yeah, she's always listening.
She's always listening. But she's handy. I mean, today I was struggling with a mop, and I realized I needed a new mop head. And so I just simply hollered, Alexa, put mop on the shopping list. And she replied back, mop has been added to your shopping list. So now that's on my phone. And when
do you
I go
feel
to
like
the
saying
store,
thank you whenever that happens?
Yes, I do.
I do all the time.
And
yeah,
I say,
you better. You better say thank
can
you.
Be. Say thank
and
you
I
to your
say
phone.
Thank you. But what typically happens is she just doesn't respond, and then I feel bad. So, but she's handy, and I suspect that that's probably what's going to come down the pike, is that it's just going to be like the bullfrog sitting in the water. Change is going to come, but the bullfrog is always representing change as a bad thing. And I think that it would be I think that AI will turn out to be a good thing and that people will adapt to all of the changes that are there, but it's going to be a heck of a transition.
Remember 25 years ago or whatever it was when they started putting computers under the hood of cars and the cars were run by, and everybody who bought one or was thinking of buying one said, oh, I don't want one of those with all those damn computers in it. Well, mm-hmm. We wouldn't even think of going back to carburetors and things like that anymore.
Well, they've got diagnostics information.
Exactly.
You've got all kinds of mileage data. And you know, Dan, one of the things that you said was, but she's handy. And that phrase, that sentiment, I worry about.
Okay.
Only because how much will we allow devices and software to do and collect on us? And how much will we allow companies to use these devices to collect information on us because it's handy? When you do your searches on Alexa, that is not just one and done and gone. Alexa then remembers that you asked for this on this date and that she added a broom. And it seems innocuous at first, but that is data that's being gleefully collected by companies like Amazon and Facebook with its facial recognition. With every picture that you've been shared in, that information is gladly collected and put together.
Exactly. I just read that Facebook shut down. I'm sorry, were you done?
No, please go ahead.
Shut down two computers because they started talking to each other in their own language.
Yes.
And they have no idea what they were planning.
Yeah, that was that Facebook?
Facebook.
Yeah.
The article I read anyway said Facebook.
And that's an event that you know about. I mean, who knows what kind of... Mm-hmm. Pardon me for sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but I am very cautious about what folks will allow the Instagram app on their phone to do without perhaps even realizing what's in those terms of services and the agreements that you sign. Simply by downloading and using the program, you give Instagram rights to things like your pictures.
Nobody reads those things when you say, do you agree? And you just check the box.
Right. Few do. Few read those.
A couple of years ago, South Park did an episode where what you were agreeing to is you were giving up your father into slavery or something like that.
But haven't we all met someone that just super impressed us of so brilliant, so smart, and it's, wow, I wish I could have thought of that or said that. And isn't that what AI would be? Would be that smart, intelligent person that we could, if we have the ability to converse, like your Alexa, if we had the ability to converse and almost always get the correct answer, they may not have the human interjection, but they would still have that intelligence to come up with darn close to the perfect answer every single time. And I would probably make homework obsolete.
and it does. And it's making education obsolete in a sense, and that everything you need to know is in your phone. And that's one of the other things that Alexa is handy for. I was doing room measurements one day, and I wanted to know how many square feet that was. So I just simply hollered out, Alexa, what's 25 times 15? And bang, whatever that is, she came back with it. And it's AI is capable of a lot of things. And what I see is that we just, this is a handy thing to have. Yeah, this is good for me. This improves my life. This improves my quality of life. And so I'm willing to accept. And Dane, you asked the question of just how much of information am I going to be willing to give? My brother-in-law is one of these computer guys. Grew up with COBOL and at the very beginnings of the computer. Yeah. And then he retired from that, but nonetheless, he follows this whole thing. And we had this conversation at length one day where he asked, I asked the question to him of, are you really sure you want to give all of this information to the system? And he says, sure, it makes my life better. And I don't see any reason why I need to worry about the information being stored or whatnot.
The fact is, all of the corporations, Dane, as you pointed out, they already have all the information. They track our cell phones. They track our PCs. They know where we surf. They have Alexa to tell them. Everything's digitized. They have cameras. They have the ability to spoof. I was watching a segment just before I came in today. A gentleman was talking about he used to be with the CIA, and he's kind of a revoltist, and he says, so my cell phone will turn on and then turn off by itself. He says, and then just so that they know that I know, they'll turn around and send me the recording of whoever I was talking to when my phone supposedly wasn't on, just to let me know, yeah, I'm messing with you. Yeah, we're recording you, and we can do whatever we want. That is our future, I think, to be quite honest. If you're on the wrong side, yeah, everything is an option. Everything's able to be tracked, traced. I don't think we can hide anymore. I really don't.
That may be one of the big fears to examine, because I think that pretty much everybody will agree that there's a class separation that is at work here. And I used to work in the security industry, and one of the things that I was very much aware of is that you can have surveillance to the point. And now with the facial recognition programs, you can have where, like, Joe comes in and he's hungry, so he's shoplifting from the store, and the store doesn't have to go through law enforcement anymore. The store can just simply post the face of the person that they caught shoplifting, and they've got the cameras now to catch people pretty much red-handed with it. So they catch them and they say, okay, you're no longer allowed to shop in this store. Further, we're going to share this information with the other stores in the town, in the country, wherever.
And not only that, Joe was driving a 1960 pickup truck. He has no cell phone. He lives out in the boonies. He thought he was isolated and not being tracked. Boom, but he's caught. That's kind of my point, is There's no place to hide anymore. You can be captured, as you pointed out, with the facial recognition. You can't hide anymore anywhere.
Right.
You can't go to a bank. You can't go to a grocery store. You're on camera. Look at, what is it, England that has cameras on every street corner?
Yeah, very prolific, at least it's particularly in London.
Absolutely. Yes. There's nowhere you can run and hide. You can't do anything anymore. You can't go to work.
Well, there are cameras here, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know that there are any in the studio, but go upstairs to the restaurant, and there are cameras in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have microphones here. You're being recorded.
Yes.
I mean, just in case you didn't know that, you're being recorded right now, Ben.
In their car right now, tuned into the radio, and they got you.
Yep.
Well, you know, Bill, I refuse to stop trying to protect my information. As daunting as it may be, and as difficult as a task as it is, I'm going to continue to do my best to stop that kind of collection from being easy. I can at least do that. I can at least take those steps and try to protect myself.
How can you do that?
Oh, there's a variety of ways. If you're talking technologically, there are some sources out there that people can check out, such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Free Software Foundation. These are organizations that will provide you as best they can with information on an operating system you could put on your computer and an operating system you could even put on your phone that might more easily help protect you. And there are techniques out there like virtual private networks that help to attempt to secure and encrypt your connection before it goes out there directly to your internet service provider to be observed. As you folks know, when you are using mobile data, your internet service provider is your cell phone provider, so AT&T or Verizon or whomever. Well, their servers are providing you with this service, and they, being the people in that organization and their computers, can collect information on what you're doing. So they see, in some cases, searches, Google searches, if you're not using encrypted searches. They see all kinds of things that you're doing with your device. And you've given them the rights to do so by purchasing that device and using mobile data. You have freely given, and in fact, when you use your hotspot and you provide your service to other people in a group, you're actually, there's text in there, but when you use your hotspot, you're allowing that company, AT&T or Verizon or whomever, to also collect information on what they are doing. Even with these companies having that kind of control, there are techniques to protect yourself. It's out there. It's difficult. You may need to find somebody who cares a lot about that sort of stuff, like yours truly, but it's possible.
So are you now willing to wear a wig and a mask and everything else to go, if you're going to go, you know, 3/10, why not go 9/10 or 10/10?
So I would call that a little fallacious, Bill, although I get exactly what you're saying. I'm not necessarily going to wear a wig and put on sunglasses and so on out of concern over the security cameras that are out there. I'm going to do it electronically. I'm going to use a VPN to put on a virtual wig, I guess you could say.
I think it might look kind of nice if you had longer hair.
Oh, well,
that's appropriate.
And with any argument, you could say, well, go to the extreme. I'm going to go as much as I can with the knowledge and time that I've got to put into it right now, because I don't want to give up the fight yet. Hopefully never.
Well, let's go back to this idea that there's those of us who are on the inside and those of us who are on the outside. And those of us who are on the outside suddenly find ourselves in a very precarious position because we just don't have whatever it takes to survive in this technological world. Did they even make 1960? No, they don't make parts for those things anymore. The Ford pickup truck or whatever.
You can still buy them. You can buy
them. Find parts, yeah.
And maybe 3D print them, huh?
Yeah, they're recycled. Yeah.
And that's another thing.
They're sent out and rebuilt.
They
and you can still buy them.
With. AI can now give us a connecting rod for a Ford, what was there? Is a 130 size engine or something? Anyway. But there's somebody who's essentially outside of the system. How do they survive? Do they have to simply fend for themselves off the land because they've been excommunicated, if you will, from society and can no longer find substance with they can't go to the grocery store because facial recognition will kick them out. They can't.
That's the extreme. Yeah.
They can't. They just can't buy anything. And so they're stuck. They're going to have to live off the land, so to speak.
Maybe I'm being naive, but who's watching me and why? My simple little boring life.
Great question.
Does somebody know I watched an episode of This Old House today, and do they care?
Where did you watch the episode? Did you watch it online, like on Netflix or YouTube?
I watched it on my smart television. But I mean, why does somebody care? You know,
You mean smart television?
My cat this morning too. These are the kind of things I do on a daily basis.
But your smart television, I can turn on randomly, from back in Langley. So
I know,
could
but
be
why,
listening to
why,
your conversations. Why, of course, I'm going to track.
Why would somebody be doing something like that to me? And
I want to know
realistically,
the demographics.
Why would I care?
Demographics, seeing what shows you also watch, so they can therefore.
Yeah, I know that. When you get one of those cards from wherever, loyalty card, they're tracing. They can tell lots of things about you by what you buy.
And that's why they track you.
Yeah, you'll get coupons.
You don't get that without tracking.
I don't care that they do that.
Precisely, you know, that's what I was saying.
When I turn on YouTube, I immediately get a selection of things that similar things that I've looked on YouTube before. That's I guess, a form of tracking.
That's handy.
But it's handy.
It's handy. It is. Mm. But it's also there. The information is also there, and that's the big question of the NSA, the National Security Agency, collecting all of this information. Well, they're not going to use it unless, of course, they suspect that you're subversive to the government because you've been talking about the Second Amendment or whatever. Mm. And now they want to take a little deeper look.
Mm-hmm.
And so can I recommend that we bring Edward Snowden into next week's conference? Because I think he'd probably have a little something to add to this, too.
Well, I don't know what it would cost to get him here, but
I could see where it could get to that point. I mean, you know, if we had sedition laws and things like that, you know, one of the
We did at one point.
We had sedition laws and things like, you know, one of the things Hitler did was put people in concentration camps because they said the war wasn't going too good, Heinrich. What do you think? So if we got to that point, I could see where I certainly wouldn't want to be tracked. But I don't think the government cares that I watched an episode of This Whole House today.
Well, I don't think they care about that. But like I say, if for some reason they suspect that you are somebody that's an enemy of the state,
or This Whole House is passing on secret information. Fake news. They're passing on fake news.
They can trump it up if they need to.
I'm not so sure that I'm worried about the government tracking me. I think I'm a lot more concerned about the media and the big corporations that are just dominating in our world now. Mm-hmm. The middle class is gone. I mean, let's face it, all the middle class has been shoved down. There's the elite, and then there's all the rest of us down here at the bottom dwellers. And I don't think the government is the one that got rid of the middle class. I could be wrong, but that's kind of my personal interpretation of what's happening. I think the major corporations have just become so money hungry, and all of this capturing, and there's still no middle class. We hear over and over how we're going to rebuild the middle class. What have you seen happen? Donald Trump, one of his premises, we're going to resolve the medical. We're going to bring the medical. We're going to get rid of Obamacare. So he said he was going to start getting decent prices. Has anybody seen where he's
his new tax proposal is also has a lot of more tax breaks for the rich than it does for
absolutely.
The middle class.
Yeah. So I mean, how
trickle down. He's got the old trickle down thing going again.
Yeah, there's nothing that he proposed before that's logical in terms of bringing this stuff down. So. Once again, it's the corporations, I think, because they're still able to say, no, we're still going to make our maximum profits, and all these people down below here are going to pay me.
What if AI came along and said, well, yeah, I recognize this as artificial intelligence with an IQ that is infinitely bigger than yours. Mm-hmm. And there's a statement that I read by some group, a think tank somewhere in Europe.
The Great Equalizer.
AI. Could be. This statement basically was that they felt that society had run out of the necessary intelligence to run the world as it is today, and that there wasn't a single person on the earth with a high enough IQ to sort it all out, or a big enough group of people to do that. And they kind of threw their hands up in the air and said, don't know where we're going from here. But so I asked the question, is it possible that we consult the Watson or whatever artificial intelligence is most dominant at the time and say, where do we go from here? And it replies back with, well, first of all, you need to equalize your cash flow here, and you need to do this, and you need to do that. And some people may object to that, but what if AI just simply takes over and makes the changes anyway? Is that something we have to surrender our freedom to this big mass of intelligence to fix for us? Let's take climate change as an example. Let's suppose that I've seen articles where various scientists have proposed spraying certain chemicals into the atmosphere, that if we did that, we would reverse the effects of the buildup of carbon in the atmosphere. We would reverse that, and there are ways that we could restore the atmosphere back to wherever. These are the same guys that are trying to figure out how to provide an atmosphere for Mars. But they're saying that, okay, that's possible. Well, who wants to take that radical of a step? But let's suppose that AI then proposes that as a solution. Do you want to trust that?
Artificial intelligence and things like databases, informational databases, are daily consulted. I don't think there's necessarily one single Watson like the IBM Watson that was on Jeopardy that's being consulted for all these things, but companies and governments will say, all right, let's look at the data and let's see, okay, where do we find most terrorists in Pakistan? And where do we find that Campbell's tomato soup sells the best and why? And how can we determine why? So in answer to your question, I would say that artificial intelligence is being consulted to an extent. If we define artificial intelligence as simulated intelligence, or if we even include data and technology in that, as we've kind of been doing in this discussion, we're kind of there. There isn't like a single Watson being rolled around and being put in a suit and a tie and being elected to government necessarily yet, but we're kind of doing that. I mean, governments, I think, and companies sort of do that already.
So you're saying that that's already a transition that's in progress now?
I would assert so, and I wonder if you gentlemen agree.
I would agree, absolutely. And I don't know that you had mentioned the dollar, the ramifications of having the dollar. The dollar is something that was built by corporate America. Look at countries over in Africa, wherever, that do not use a dollar. They simply use a barter system. Those people live and live well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The dollar is not really an answer, I don't think, or a solution to a problem. I don't know that money, I mean, it is in our economy here, but once again, that's the big business that has forced us into thinking the dollar is the ultimate end. I don't know that that's really a solution. AI, I don't think, is going to care about a dollar bill one way or the other.
Hmm. I would think that it would.
It's going to care about the intelligence.
The reason that I say that is the dollar is nothing more than a symbol. The dollar simply says that you come over to my house and you nail this board up for me and I give you $10. And you take the $10 and you go to the store and you buy a case of beans or food for the day.
But I would also come over and do it for a case of beer, and there's no money involved. So, I mean, there's another way outside of the dollar to still get the same performance or better.
If you're just hanging up a board for a case of beer is okay, but suppose you're buying a new car. You know, how many cases of beer do we need to trade? And where'd you get the money to buy the case of beer? Did you trade? I think we're way, way far too sophisticated a society, almost the entire world, is to live on any kind of a barter system, unless you're...
Well, it streamlines the whole thing. I mean, if you're having to argue about, okay, what do I have that you want to nail the board up for me? And you say, well, I kind of like that. And I say, well, I don't know that I necessarily want to part with that. How about this? And you say, but I've got five of those. I don't need that one. And we could argue for 3 hours or so about what you want in trade. We would barter on it, whereas the money allows you, it's kind of like energy. There's a transition there. If you have matter, you've got one thing. But if you can convert the matter to energy, now you can create something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the money allows you to make that kind of a transition. You go from goods and services into the state of money. And then you go from the state of money back into goods and services. So I think that the dollar is an important part in the ability of the society, of the system. Let's call it a system at this point, because it's worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that allows this system to function smoothly because
we're way too complicated to have anything but a currency system, whether it's a dollar or a yen or a rand or whatever. It's just, I assume that's what you mean when you say dollar.
Yeah.
Because we can't just pay your phone bill with a basket full of chickens or something like that. As simple as the thing we do every day. You know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Easier perhaps to put it all in a bank or a credit card company and use a card and make your transactions that
way. Exactly. Yeah.
And let's assume for a moment that AI comes along and looks at the situation and says, well, I don't really see any way to talk to these people. They just don't have enough intellect to be able to understand the situation. So what's in the best position to hack everything that's out there? Let's say that there's an AI sitting back in the background watching all of this and basically hacking everything, and then one day decides to just fix things. and does a little hacking, and so suddenly you discover your bank account's $1,000 richer, and you wonder, where the hell did that come from? And it just quietly fixes things while nobody's really aware of what's going on, with just a whole system of errors, and it's capable of following all of the transactions in the world that are done electronically at the same time, sort it out, and come with corrective measures, and says absolutely nothing to us about it.
And transfers all semi-loads of bottled water down to Texas and Louisiana.
Right.
From the minute Harvey hits. But yeah, that would be, I mean, actually that would be a good move if it could pull something like that off. Immediately transfer all of those, knowing that water is in dire need down there. Yeah, that would be a fantastic opportunity.
But leaving us out of the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
Just sneaking in, what's the expression, the camel and the nose, the camel's nose in the tent, just kind of sneaking in a little bit at a time. And then suddenly we discover one day that we just really aren't in control at all.
And there's a camel in the tent.
And there's a camel in the tent.
I would say that what's being described sounds a lot like true artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. a device that can make a decision that has not been designed or programmed into it. At present, you know, databases, they do what they're told to do and programmed to do. And in Ray's much earlier description of medical technology, you would say that the robot can perform a surgery better than a single doctor. And you might recall that the device was programmed and perhaps given the data of many, many doctors. Mm-hmm. And probably their experience in saying, hey, when you see this black blotch here, right, it usually means this. And when that device sees 1,000 black blotches of all this different size, and it compares all these thousands all at once, faster than any single doctor possibly could, then that single device is better than a single doctor for sure. But true artificial intelligence, I think, is pretty far beyond us at this stage. Right now, a lot of what we got is technology that is designed to respond in a certain way. And Watson, the IBM device on Jeopardy, was able to search through a database of knowledge. I would say that it wasn't necessarily thinking for itself. But again, that's kind of getting into the definitions a little bit. And that's getting into the weeds. I also brought over something, knowing about this discussion, about the intersection between jobs, employment, which Bill brought up earlier, and artificial intelligence. There have been developments to create autonomous vehicles in the trucking industry.
Mm-hmm.
And as that continues to develop, and as trucking uses automation to deliver goods, that is a lot of people that are going to be out of jobs. Is that a good thing, or is it a bad thing?
Well,
not the loss of jobs, I should say. Is this development in technology a good thing or a bad thing, knowing that jobs are going to be lost? Some jobs are going to be created maintaining these autonomous vehicles and their programming. Is this a good thing overall, or a bad thing?
There's been advances in the past where we've gone to mechanize things to do our work, which was more simple than,
sure,
than AI. Historically, jobs have, if not kept up, they've grown.
What are some examples of automation take over? Like,
yeah,
the automobile replaced the horse and buggy. What are you going to do with the horse and buggy now? There's
sure.
no need. We replaced them with a car. That's stupid.
Cotton gin.
Yeah.
Weaving.
Automotive assembly lines look totally different now than they used to.
People had to.
Henry Ford, it's all his fault.
You watch any How It's Made video and you see how many human beings,
right?
Maybe a few, that are, you know, wearing suits.
It's actually surprising when you see somebody performing a function.
Yeah.
Holding something.
Oh, who's that guy?
Putting something in a box or something like that. Is holy cow, somebody touched this.
And it's not just trucking either. They're talking about doing the same thing with automobiles to where you really, the corporation supplies an automobile. You just call a number or hit a thing on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
A vehicle arrives. You mm-hmm. get in. You take it to your destination. And then it's already programmed
automated
for some.
Taxis, yeah.
So all you do is, you're renting a taxi. You don't buy a car anymore, so you don't need the money to buy a vehicle.
So that's taxi drivers, Uber drivers, Lyft drivers all out of jobs, of those jobs,
well,
right?
There's a lot of people out of jobs right now because of technology, and
sure.
corporations during the last recession had just learned how to be leaner and do things with machines and to do things better and faster, and they don't need as many workers.
The coal miners are an excellent example of that right now. Coal is defunct. I mean, it's extinct. We don't use coal anymore. And all these economies and people and states are dependent upon coal mining, but it's just not there.
Dan, what do you think?
There was a guy on the news this morning. His name is Reid Hoffman. And he's the co-founder of LinkedIn, and he's a board member on Microsoft and Airbnb. And essentially what he said was that he feels that AI is going to bring about an increase in productivity. Mm-hmm. And he cited the automobile as an example. He said the automobile basically is what created Suburbans. Mm-hmm. And the automobile, when it first came out, was seen as a threat. And, he pointed out that the there was a law on the books in some places where you had to walk, have someone walk in front of the automobile with a flag to let you know the automobile was coming through. They were seen as a real menace. They did, however, clean up a lot of pollution from horses in New York City, particularly, where there, you know, the people who shoveled up all of the stuff that the horses left.
Well, not only that, when the horse died, sometimes it just laid there in place and decomposed.
Oh, somebody had to clean that up.
So those horse poop cleaners had to become Java programmers. Is that right?
Yes. Well, okay, we're about out of time on this topic, so let's kind of sum it up if we can, if we can go around the table. I'll start. I think basically what we've said is that artificial intelligence is going to affect our lives in ways that we haven't even imagined yet, and we're going to have to make adjustments in our lives to be able to deal with AI, and it may sneak up on us, and we may not necessarily realize what has happened. It may just be like cars have just come into existence, and it isn't as if we had any decision in that particular process, but they're here. And I think my personal opinion is that AI is going to do the same thing. I think it's already here, just not quite as smart as we would like for it to be.
And I'm inclined to agree. I believe that AI is here. I think we've been using it in our vehicles. The Alexa that you had mentioned, the artificial intelligence is out there. I was pro-computer from the time I first got on the computer. I think AI is going to be a natural relationship, I guess, to the PC. And I think that the technology is coming, and it's a positive advancement as I see it, my opinion.
I obviously think it's coming as well, and I don't know all that much about it. I find it a little bit scary, and a little bit scarier that Elon Musk, who is certainly no stranger to AI, uses it constantly, is concerned about the possibilities of it.
You know, I, like Bill, I like computers very much. They're it's my job, it's my livelihood. However, I remain cautious of the use of artificial intelligence and databases to surveil people. I will continue to stand against that as best I can. I sympathize with the thousands and perhaps millions who are going to lose their jobs to automation, and I hope that those people can reach a new source of employment somehow in this world, whatever kind it may be. I don't want, you know, the coal miners and truck drivers and taxi drivers to be unemployed for the rest of their lives because the use of automation and companies' choice to use automation has pushed them out of the job. I want them to have somewhere they can go, whether it be into programming or some other field, where they won't be left behind by technology. So I'm cautious. I'm pessimistic, I suppose, but I still like computers. I'm still going to pay attention to the development of artificial intelligence.
And you, the listener, what is your opinion? What do you think? Join us. Send us a letter, send us a card, send us an email. Let us know your thoughts. Ask questions, whatever. Join the discussion here at Brookings Cafe.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.